Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on what collection agencies teach in their training programs. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Peak Revenue Learning. You'll get the chance to hear more about that, or more about the company a little later in our program. I also wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, including the Daily Digest email newsletter and the Getting to Know weekly profile, as well as hosts webinars like this and delivers information across a multitude of communication channels. The site has recently launched 3 new podcasts and more are on the horizon. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what the site has to offer. Now, let me take a minute and tell you a little bit about today's speakers. LaDonna Bowling started at Contract Callers in 1996 as manager of their utility collections portfolio. She then became the trainer for the agency. Her mission in the agency was to change the mindset of the collection staff to treat consumers with dignity and respect, showing them that you can be successful as a collector using consumer-friendly methods. She currently serves as the company's director of call center operations and is very active with the Georgia Collectors Association, having served on their board since 2010. Possessing more than 30 years of experience in the collection industry, Bob Dunkel has transitioned from a primary role of training and development to the position of compliance officer and ombudsman at Williams & Fudge. In addition to ensuring that the compliance requirements in the industry have a positive effect on the success of Williams & Fudge by imparting the professional and ethical concepts of proper collection techniques, Bob creates a balance of performance incentives with compliance objectives. He oversees the compliance management system, identifying and managing risk in consumer dispute resolution and complaint handling, policies and procedures as they pertain to daily operations and training. Kelly Kruger is the Vice President of Organizational Development and Training for CBE Companies. She has 22 years experience in training and development and currently oversees all matters relating to employee development and engagement. She's been with CBE on and off since 1996 and specializes in sales, persuasion, customer service, recovery, and management training. Her trainings focus on the development of human talent, utilizing the latest innovations in human performance technology. Kelly Parsons O'Brien is the president of Pacific Credit Services, formerly known as Credit Bureau Associates. She's a third-generation debt collector, having worked for the family business since 1994. Kelly took a small break from the business for an adventure in college. It's a couple of jobs, including working at Wells Fargo and Sierra Springwater. She came back to Credit Bureau Associates in 1998 to take on the adventure of being the collections manager. In January of 2015, Kelly, along with her business partner, purchased the company. Kelly also currently serves as president for the California Association of Collectors. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by me. We encourage everyone to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter or type it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. And with that, let's begin today's discussion. LaDonna, I'll give you the honor of the first question. Let's start sort of at the beginning. How much time do you think an agency should spend when training new employees?
Well, that's a good question, Mike. And during my tenure here at CCI, we've changed it up a few times. When I first came here, you know, back in the dark ages, we spent 5 days training. And at the end of those 5 days, you were given a headset and put on the telephone. We've become a little bit more sophisticated. And now we have a 10-day initial training program, and it's a very structured program. And then our new hires go into what's called a nesting period with a supervisor, and they work doing live work for 2 weeks, and then they're actually, you know, given their title of, you know, professional collector, and can then start collecting money.
I would like to, this is Bob Dunkel. I'd like to add that our initial training period is a period of 5 days, not unlike what you had stated. But after 5 days, we do put them on the phone in a closely monitored environment where they are right there at team leaders as well as row captains, and they work in a 6 month to year period in a pooled environment as they continue to learn the basics before they've been able to demonstrate their skill set. So the initial 5 day period is giving them just the basics, and then with ongoing training and development, they spend 6 months to a year before they're able to work on their own individual cues.
Thanks, Bob. We have two Kellys, so Kelly Parsons is going to be Kelly with a Y today. So Kelly with a Y, why don't you walk us through the training program at your agency?
So ours is similar to LaDonna and Bob's. We do an 8-day mandatory training. So we were having trouble with people not making it through the training program or having things come up that they forgot to tell us in the application process. So we, part of their job offer is that those 8 days are mandatory. So they must attend all first 8 days of training. They ideally would be on the phone around day six. So, but that would be in like the conference room, all four or five of them, depending on our training group at the time, would sit down and make calls together. So we'd be making one call after the other. I'd be there to kind of help them. And what it really helped us is for them to see a lot more calls than sitting out on the floor with, you know, and shadowing the other collectors. So we're very similar. And then they training over the next 90 days goes through like policies, procedures, and then they'll move back to the collection manager, who's currently me, and to develop their skills. So the collection supervisor gets to teach them all the good stuff of how to work the accounts, making sure they're staying compliant, and then I get to help them collect more money at the end of that 90 days.
Excellent, thanks. And Kelly Krueger, can you walk us through the training program at CBE?
So I can say that pretty consistent with what everybody else is saying. I think that one thing, I'm sure everybody does something similar to this, is before they get on the phones to take live calls and before they go out to the floor and shadow, we bring seasoned, tenured collectors that we trust into the training room, and they take live calls in front of the class. And then that allows that class to, well, after the call, they can really watch what's going on, but after the call, really stop and debrief what happened and maybe what could have that collector could have done differently, or ask questions on why they did something in a certain way. We started that a couple of years ago, and I've really noticed, and we do that probably in day three of their being employed, and that has really helped people understand what the job is really about. Because when you're out shadowing, you really don't feel comfortable talking one-on-one sometimes with the person that you're shadowing with. So just a huge impact in regards to retention.
I think that's a good point, because you know, we let the trainees listen to you know, previously recorded and scored calls. We have some good calls and some bad calls, but I think that's a great idea, having it happen live in front of them, and they can even see the collector's body language and facial expressions while it's happening. So I've learned something. Good takeaway for me.
Kelly, can you talk a little bit? You said you've been doing it for a couple of years now. Was this just, was it something else you'd seen someone else do, and that's why you decided to start doing it? Or talk about how you sort of came to integrate or incorporate that into your training?
Well, it actually started when we opened up a new office and we didn't have anybody for the collectors to shadow. So, because like the maiden voyage, so we brought a collector with us into with us to do that new, very first training with that new office. And it was really, it came, that whole thing kind of came out of need or accident, and it just really took off. And as we watched it kind of unfold, we're like, oh my gosh, we should do this ongoing and here on out. And it does allow you to really hand select one person that you know is going to do exactly what you want them to do, and they're going to do it right. And it also helps us build bench strength for the next trainer too. So somebody who wants to be a trainer, we then kind of handpick that person and say, okay, well, this is one of the first steps to becoming a trainer, is you need to make sure you're doing it right on the phone, even when nobody's looking, but especially when you've got 37 people looking.
Yeah, and I agree with that, Kelly, that we utilize our top collectors and encourage them to join our mentoring program because, well, two things happen. As you're teaching, you also reiterate what you have learned. And that because they are top performers, they're going to learn more from their peers because I found that when our director of training, myself or any other supervisors, are telling them this is how you need to do it, they expect us to say that. But when their peers who are being successful say this is how I've done it, they tend to do it more often and mirror and emulate those that are successful and have proven a successful track record.
Interesting. So Kelly Parsons, going back to something you mentioned with some of the difficulties that agencies have in kind of getting people through the training process and sort of the high turnover that can sometimes occur during training. What's the best way to kind of start training a new employee? Or what works for you?
So our office has had success with a buddy program that I implemented, about 6 months ago. So we have a senior staff member, somebody that's been here more than 90 days, and they don't have to work in collections. They can work in clerical or client services or our legal department. And then they do a buddy. We sign them up with each other. So I kind of look at the experience or age group of the new hire coming on and what I know about our current employee and try to match them up pretty well. And so really what we focus on in the very beginning, the very first day after the new hire paperwork is done, is company culture. We have about an hour and a half expectation meeting that the buddy has with the new hire. They get to know them. They show them around the office. They introduce them to some people. I have kind of an overview of things that I want covered during that meeting. But really, they get a chance to just kind of get to know each other and teach them about the, unwritten rules that every office has. And then once that's done, and then part of the buddy program also kind of jumping ahead to the end of the week is we also sponsor them for lunch on Friday. So after they've gone through training, then they get a chance to go to lunch with their buddy company, I give them a gift card to go to one of the local restaurants. And so we've really found that that's really where the training starts, because if I can get them integrated into the company quickly, then I find that they're more successful at staying. And that's been true for our last, four hire groups since I started that 6 months ago. And we found that it works out. It's worked really well for our training group. And then of course, the FDCPA is our next step. And I know that I've talked to several people that kind of like, well, they need to understand how collections works. They need to understand the computer before they really understand the law. But I find that if we start with the FDCPA and kind of get the tough stuff out of the way first, I think that it really starts the platform for the compliance that I'm expecting from the staff from day one. And so, I think that that's really, for us, the two places that we find are most successful in starting that, and then it really develops the rest of the training, how to make calls, computer, all those other things that need to come along.
Yeah, I agree with that statement, because if they learn your culture, they learn what's expected, and then you hold them to the compliance of FDCPA and other federal and state regulations, it sets the tone for what you expect down the road. And so if they understand the culture is of setting the bar very high with regard to compliance, then they tend to learn that quicker, and you can hold them accountable. And if there are any slip-ups, you can go back to your initial training and you recall we trained you on this and you're on the onset. So FDCPA and compliance, I think, are primary in on the onset, because it just continues to help them direct them down the path that they need to be on.
So I'm going to take this in a different direction, because, we used to do that too. We used to, and we always had the battle of the chicken before the egg. What's more important, mm-hmm. The regulations or the system, because they need to understand both. But we actually noticed we were having a lot of turnover in training. And so what we realized is that if we can create loyalty within those new hires within the first couple of days, and our turnover rate actually reduced drastically. So I think what we determined is the best way to start training is to make them feel like they matter as part of our family, and letting them know that we're going to invest in them. And so we start doing soft skills training on the, well, you know, the first day would they get to sign the paperwork to become part of our family and get a little carpal tunnel. But after that, we send them through 2 full days of soft skills training. And it's all kind of based off of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And it's literally 2 full days of intensive training, and it's all about them and how to be better people at home is really where we focus on, because we feel if you're a better person at home, then you're a better person at work. So it really helped. And then we started really thinking, okay, what is our end in mind with our new hires, and what do we want our employees, our new employees, to say to their friends and family on their, after they walk out of the door on their first day of employment, because, you know, their friends and family are going to ask them, how do you like your job? And what do we want that answer to be? And so it really moved us into let's develop them as people. So when they do talk about us and talk about their new job, that they're talking about, oh, well, they invested in me and they're trying to make me a better person. So we actually call the training Better You.
And I think that's great. And we're kind of in sync with that, because if you look at unemployment rates across the nation, we have the biggest talent shortage since 2007. And that was from a study done by the Manpower Group in 2017. So when employees come in, you know, they're looking to see if they can belong here. And, you know, we don't follow what you do exactly, but, you know, we do start out with a company history that includes our values, our mission statement. But we do then give an industry overview so they can understand, you know, how important, you know, what we do is to our economy, and, you know, let them know that they are entering, you know, to be a professional. And then we, you know, we go in with some of the laws and such, but we tie it into their emotional intelligence with their soft skills, so that they know how to develop empathy and communicate effectively and learn problem solving, you know, while we're going through the laws and such. You know, 85 to 87% of employee success is due to personal skills, you know, like their emotional intelligence. And I think that we're on the right track with that. You know, historically, I think we drove the success of our training by test scores. FDCPA, they made, you know, 95%, we'll keep them. FCRA, they made 90%, we'll keep them, you know, et cetera. So now it's a whole different ball game.
Excellent. At this point, I'd like to pause the discussion for just a minute and invite Chris Rickman from Peak Revenue Learning to say a few words. Chris?
Thank you, Mike, and hello, everyone. I am grateful for the opportunity to sponsor today's webinar. My company provides KnowledgeLink, a web-based employee education and compliance training application to companies in the collection industry. KnowledgeLink is used by our clients to simplify and lower the cost of training new and existing employees. Our clients are companies that want to build and maintain a high level of assurance that their staff members have mastered and are maintaining their mastery of the knowledge expected of them when interacting with consumers. KnowledgeLink automatically builds documentation of the compliance training efforts of the company for existing and prospective clients and for regulators. For those of you I don't know or haven't met, I've spent most of my career on your side of the desk. I've worked in the collection industry for more than 30 years, most of that time in executive management of a collection firm. KnowledgeLink was created to address many of the shortcomings in training and compliance I saw as COO and CEO. Use KnowledgeLink to implement an ongoing continuous training cycle, reinforcing the knowledge you expect staff members to have before it begins to fade from memory. Present collection client or company policies to your staff members during onboarding training and at ongoing recurring schedules where they acknowledge they have read and understand those policies. Present tests during training events to validate learning or on recurring schedules to certify staff knowledge in areas you wish, such as the FDCPA or HIPAA. You can use KnowledgeLink during training events to present videos or audio recordings or slideshows, followed by a set of questions to validate participation in learning. In summary, KnowledgeLink will close knowledge gaps, promote accountability, lower the cost of training, document for prospective and existing clients, regulators, or auditors of your company's proactive role in preventing compliance nonconformities. For more information, you can visit us at peakrevenuelearning.com. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks, Chris, and thanks again to Peak Revenue Learning for sponsoring today's webinar. Let's pick up our discussion. We've talked a little bit about sort of the components of what sort of constitutes or comprises an effective training program, culture, FDCPA, obviously. Kelly Krueger was talking about soft skills. But LaDonna, let me reach out to you and ask you, are there other core components that you think are required or should be included in a training program?
Yes. You know, in addition to, you know, the acts that we all have to know, you know, and then with UDAP and FDCPA, all of those things, you also have to add in, you know, your HR things that need to be taught. But again, you know, our biggest thing are the soft skills and focusing on the emotional intelligence, because once the new hire learns that, and it does, you know, it helps them in their personal life as well as their professional life, then they buy into more of what we do, because, you know, we're on the phone with consumers and we're trying to control the conversations by controlling our emotions. So our, you know, new hires, our collectors can, you know, control, you know, the consumer so that, you know, the conversation ends the way we want it to end, you know, resolving the account.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that, LaDonna. And I think that's one of the toughest things for a new collector to learn is to how to manage their emotions. And we try to instill in them the adage that, you know, don't take this personally, that you want to collect from someone like you would want to be collected from if you were on the other end. But because of sometimes the high emotions in a conversation, that people learn that skill over time. And so what we tell them a lot of times is the best way to learn that is to come back and listen to a call that you deem was a kind of a tough call, and what could you have done differently? And I think once they've removed themselves from the day-to-day and the face-to-face with that consumer, and they can hear how they reacted, they get an opportunity to hear some creative suggestion on how you could have better handled that call. So I think you're right, and one of the basic soft skills is learning how to manage your emotions, because we know that a call can quickly go south if they are not maintaining that.
Absolutely. I completely agree. That is one of the biggest struggles that we come across is the controlling your emotions. We started kind of tying it to confidence. So we started doing confidence training as well, which we thought was a little out of the box. But if people are confident in their ability to handle a call and their ability to get to the end of and get to resolution and maintain control of their emotions, then it did help with that. So we kind of tied in those confidence and then problem solving skills, you know, and how to be curious. Those are kind of some of the most important skills we've discovered are necessary for a collector to be successful.
And that's development of the person as a whole and not just, you know, the one-sided from the employer looking down saying, you know, employee development, you know, that's personal development, which, you know, I think one of you mentioned at the beginning, you know, let's the employee understand that we are buying into them. You know, we're trying to help them and, you know, make them be, you know, the best that they can be. Because, you know, anybody can learn the FDCPA and you know that you can't call before 8, you can't call after 9, but these things are done with a little finesse and a little bit of art to it.
And I also think that showing them how our top collectors are successful. So I know, like, we post our totals on the board, and, you know, when you're a new hire thinking like, oh, how am I possibly going to collect as much money as this person that's been there 5, 10, 15 years, trying to get them to see, like, these are the skills that make those people successful, and really having them, you know, engage with that employee. So your senior staff are the ones that are making you the most money, asking them to really help build the new hire group by saying, you know, coming in and saying, you know, what are the things that I think make me successful? And, you know, these are the things I've tried that didn't work. These are the things that are working for me. And these are the parts of the training that you're going to want to pay attention to the most. And We really found that that way they can see that this is reachable, and instead of just hearing it from the trainer or the manager, hearing it from the employee that started where they started and ended up as our top performer, really what that road looked like for them. And we found that that's really part, you know, part of the core of our training program as well.
So we've talked about what should be taught to new employees. Maybe let's spend a little bit of time talking about how that, you know, this information should be taught. You know, there's a lot of information. It can be overwhelming. It can be disheartening, maybe is a word sometimes. There's just people don't think they'll be able to grasp it all. So what have you found to be the best way to try and teach these components? And Kelly Krueger, I'll ask you to start first.
So we do this thing called teachbacks, where we give the class the content that they need to know, and then we have them create the training around it. So it's really some of the more difficult stuff that they have to learn, because you know, our theory is the best way to learn is to teach. So we give them the content and say, you need to teach that, you need to create a training, and that training must include discussion, an activity, and a knowledge check that you're going to present to the class. And we divide them into teams, and each team has to get a certain period of time to create this training, and then they get a certain amount of time that they can present it. And each individual has to play an important role in that creation and presentation, so no one gets to just sit back and do nothing. And honestly, what this does is it teaches them also tools beyond what the content they're supposed to learn. It teaches them confidence. It teaches them problem-solving skills, creativity, communication, and public speaking. So that's kind of a creative way in which we can teach some of those maybe less than fun things to teach.
No, it's all fun.
Kelly, how big are your training groups normally?
I mean, it could range from 5 people to 35, 36 people. In some of our divisions, our average classes are 36 people. So our trainers love it because they can sit back and you know, ask the questions like a new hire.
I like the idea. So how much of the training is covered this way?
I would say one section of a larger section of the training. So not soft skills. We don't usually teach soft skills that way. Probably mostly client specifics are taught that way.
Oh, I like that. That's a great idea.
You guys embracing the modern learner,
yeah.
You know, not so much as, you know, death by PowerPoint management, you know, driven, you know, top-down training that's kind of bottom-up, you know, letting employees drive it. And I think that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're really trying to be a learner-centered training program.
Yeah. I have a question for you guys. Do you find that the larger the class, the more difficult it is for your trainer, or do you think that, and I heard you say 35, our normal class size is 10, now, we've had as many as 15 in a class, and the trainers have expressed some concern with retention because they feel like they're spread thin. So I guess my question is, do you feel that you're more effective with a larger class or a medium-sized class?
I mean, it really depends on the talent of the trainer, but mm-hmm. I would say our trainers like the larger classes because we also do a lot of team building in those classes. So when they do transfer to the floor, then they transfer as a group and they transfer as a team, and they're dedicated in to each other. So it's, again, it creates loyalty within the classroom. And, you know, when you have 100 different personalities, when you only have 15 people, that loyalty to each other is a little bit smaller because there's so many different kinds of personalities and not that many people to select from to become a best mm-hmm. friend with.
Okay.
Remember, one of the rules of engagement is having a best friend at work, and we try to create that in the classroom.
That's good. Good advice.
Yeah, as a trainer, I don't like a small class because I like to get a hubbub going and, you know, hear the buzz in the class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't like any less than 20 people. You know, 15 to 20 people to me is ideal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anything less than that, and it's hard for me to stay focused. I must, you know, admit.
So, and I guess we're a little unique. So we have 15 collectors kind of on average on our collection floor. So my higher groups are somewhere between 4 and 6 people. And for me, you know, not working in a larger agency where we would have the need for 30 employee, you know, 30 group or 30 people groups, I find that it gives me the opportunity for the one-on-one interaction. So it helps me kind of get to know the employee as the owner and also as the trainer. And it creates an environment that, you know, the staff feels a little bit more comfortable coming to me. I have an open door policy, but when I wasn't doing the training or involved with as much in the new hire process, is that open door policy didn't really work because they didn't really get to know me. And so this way for us, having a bit of a smaller agency, having that 4 to 6, any more than 6, it's difficult for me to build those one-on-one relationships, which is important in our company culture. So,
yeah.
Let me change gears for a second and go back to everybody's favorite topic, that being, of course, the FDCPA. How much of it should be taught? You know, do you teach everything in the FDCPA? Do you teach the stuff that's really maybe only just mostly relevant to the collectors? I'd like to get a sense of that. And Bob, I'll start with you.
Yeah. What we do in the initial training is we go from FDCPA from A to Z. And once we feel, and we test and we determine where their lack of retention is with regard to the entire FDCPA, after we've gone back and shored that up, then it's just a continual reiteration of requirements. But we focus mostly on third party, where your biggest liability lies, and harassment. Telling, you know, of course, our harassment is not being defined in the FDCPA. You have to be mindful that the way that you interact with a consumer could create a complaint and down the road create liability. So dealing with third parties, harassment, overall basic, I think we go back to soft skills with that, how you're speaking to this, not what you say so much, but how you say it. So understanding that we're in a consumer-centric environment now, that we need to make sure that third-party handling is done in the correct manner according to the FDCPA, and just overall basic consumer interaction, your overall communication skill sets is what sets you apart from other non-professionals in our industry, and that they can learn that the way that you speak to people, being very consumer friendly, if you will, and that helps us eliminate a lot of concerns with regard to FDCPA. So I'd say third party and communication skills is where we put most of our focus.
I think we're very similar to Bob, is, you know, we still teach the technical parts of the FDCPA. I took the desk guide that ACA had and went through and kind of did like an overview training guide. And then we actually go through the FDCPA essentials for collectors that the FDCPA, you know, that ACA put out. And we use that kind of for our training. And then after that, every part of our training on like how to talk to people, how to make phone calls, we talk about what areas, you know, are we concerned about from UDAP or FDCPA, and then also the California Rosenthal Act for us, and kind of go over those things with them. I heard at the Spring Forum, one of the things that somebody had made a suggestion, or the way they train their new hires, is actually have them do third-party calls, like skip trace calls, before they have them talk to consumers. And I thought it was kind of an interesting way, you know, we're so excited to get the consumer on the phone, and many times we get that third party and aren't exactly sure how to handle that. And I think that that's where the risk of violating the FDCPA comes into play. And I'm kind of thinking that if you just put them in front of the third parties first, then it'll be that much easier to handle those when they're actually trying to reach, you know, Bob or Joe.
We like to give an overview, you know, history, of course, of the FDCPA, and then who has oversight as far as regulatory authorities. And then we focus a lot on right party identification and, you know, going through all the various types of right parties and how you communicate with it, with each. And, you know, we spend some time on attorney involvement to make sure that the collectors understand that, because sometimes we see errors in that when there's an attorney and the collector didn't really code the account correctly, and then an off, you know, hand call was made accidentally. And we focus a lot on disputes, making sure that, you know, our staff know, you know, how to handle verbal disputes and written disputes, and And then, just like Bob said, you know, a lot on harassment, you know, and what is considered harassment, you know, other than the six or eight things that are common. There are, you know, many forms of harassment, but those are about the biggest things that we do let them, we do go over everything, but some things we just kind of gloss over as a FYI, but a lot of the other things that I mentioned, we spend a lot of time on.
We're on the same page as that too. We really focus on some of the things that the collectors have control over. So we teach the FDCPA and we teach the whole FDCPA, but like she just said, we really focus on areas that collectors could make mistakes that would make an impact on us financially. And we really spend a lot of time on that. And then we also focus on, I mean, I think we all are more conservative than maybe the FDCPA says. So we do spend a lot of time teaching them our interpretation, our conservative interpretation of the laws that are out there and the difference. Like, this is what the FDCPA says, but this is how we do it. Because we were finding it was getting muddy when it was time to test them. You know, according to the FDCPA, you can use an alias. Well, we don't use aliases. So how do we test that without causing confusion? So we really, we spend a majority of the day talking about our interpretation of the law and test based on our interpretation of the law, which is always more conservative than the law. So it protects us a lot
and
more.
We'll always put a footnote, you know, to say, hey, but we're going to go over state laws and you're going to see how this differs, you know, like when communicating with spouses and those types of things, because, you know, to your point, a lot of times those are things that will get us into trouble, you know. If you go by federal law, it's okay to talk to the spouse, but, you know, some other states and other laws will differ with you on that.
Kelly, you kind of introduced my next question for me, and that's testing. I'd like to maybe hear from the other panelists on sort of what kind of testing they do with respect to the FDCPA and sort of how that process works, especially in the event where maybe a new hire doesn't do as well on the test as he or she is supposed to. And maybe Kelly Parsons or Brian, I'll start with you.
So I always feel like a failure when my new hires don't pass the test. So some things that we have done to help them is kind of get outside of the class environment. So before I put them on a test, and we have tests that we built, and they go through and they have to have a passing score. But what we do is we go over like quizzes. I step outside. I know I'm from California, so it's a little easier to step outside most days. So we go outside and we go through quizzes and games that we play usually outside, gets them out of the training room, gets them moving around. And then we also use flashcards for information. So these are ways that we've found to really, you know, we go through the discussion, we go through maybe the visuals through a PowerPoint or something like that. They've talked about the law, we've gone through all of these steps, and so my goal is really to make sure that they can pass the test without even sitting in front of the test. And then the ones that don't pass on their first time, we do give them a second time to pass it. But we're kind of strict about it. You know, if they can't pass the FDCPA test after their second attempt and we've done retraining, at that point, it really tells me about their ability to learn information. Because it really, in my mind, and granted, I've been doing this a long time, the FDCPA is pretty straightforward. And it's not super technical. It's, you know, really about treating people the way that they need to be treated, in my opinion. And that's the way we handle the training. And that's how our test questions are written as well. And so the way that we look at it is, as long as they, you know, the certain things like, you know, the 3 to 10 day on the post-data check letter, that kind of stuff is the only real technical stuff that they need to memorize. Everything else is really about treating consumers correctly in our mind.
I agree. And now I'll tell you, in the beginning, before they leave the classroom, they are required to pass a standardized FDCPA 50-question test. Then we provide them with ongoing retention testing through what we call our Got It program. And they might answer anywhere from 5 to 10 questions, just a very informal. We send it out to the staff just to make sure that they are reminded of the requirements of the FDCPA and any other type of state or federal regulations. So continue testing after the initial, because I agree with, I think it was Kelly who said, or that if they can't pass on that second, then they're not paying attention, they're not giving it the attention that it deserves, or they just are not able to learn. And if they can't pass a basic FDCPA test after being given a day of training in that area, then that could create some concerns down the road.
Yeah, we look at it the same way. It's skill versus will at that point, because it's not like you give them the test, and I'm sure this is the case for everyone. You give them the test, and whatever questions they miss, you go over to make sure, because they understand it when they do transition to the floor, even if they do pass it. But those who don't pass it, you go over those questions, give them a second time. For us, after a second time, they go through a retraining, which is an e-learning, which is 2 hours of e-learning. It's self-guided, but you can't move from one slide unless you've done action on each slide. So if they don't pass it the third time, I mean, Kelly had a valid point, is it, you know, it's time to question their ability to retain information. And this is probably the easiest piece of the next 2 weeks of their learning.
I take, just like Kelly said, I take it personal if someone doesn't do well. I look at, if someone doesn't do well, I say, well, what did I do wrong? Did I not try to reach this person? And, you know, I think what helps us with good test scores is, as we're going through the materials, I'll say things like, you'll see this in a written question form at a later time. And because, you know, some adults, they kind of freak out a little bit if they know that there's going to be a test. You know, they haven't been in a classroom environment in a long time, and sometimes tests send shudders up and down their spine. So I try to make them comfortable with that and tell them that our objective is to make sure they know the material and not to try to trick them up or say you failed.
Interesting. Thank you. One quick question, maybe not a quick question, but I was wondering whether any of you train or spend any time on like call baiting, or, you know, dealing with individuals on the phone who might be trying to bait or get a collector to commit some, you know, a violation of the FDCPA, for example, talking about disputes or things like that. Do you spend any time on baiting techniques?
If I may, I'll take that one. Yeah, we have created a list of the types of questions that call baiting, and I can't recall, but several years ago there was an opportunity, an attorney from out on the West Coast was giving these seminars and said that these are the most frequently asked questions regarding disputing, credit reporting, what would happen if I don't pay, and any type of baiting questions. So we've created a program around that, and that is part of our retention program. Well, I mentioned earlier the Got It. We ask these questions: what do you do, and how do you respond to these types of questions? And in the event that you feel like you're being baited, then we've encouraged them to incorporate the supervisor in a takeover call, just to make sure that it is a baiting call, or is it just sounding that way. But either way, I think it's, you err on the side of caution. And if you feel like you're being baited, then it's best to escalate that call to a team leader who is better adapted at handling those type of calls.
Well, and we spend a lot of time. So our new hires don't take inbound calls for almost 60 days. So we found that the call baiting happens a lot more often in the environment of inbounds. And so we've found that just keeping them off of the inbound calls for two reasons. One is because of the call baiting, the compliance risks, and them just not being as experienced. And the other side of that is I think that collectors see that inbound as kind of a money source and really don't focus on the outbound calls. And so for our office, we found that keeping the inbounds kind of away from the new hires for about 60 days really shows them that they can be successful making outbound collection calls. And I think for our office, that was really important for us, is to teach them that it's their money, it's their mouth that makes the money, and they can do that by making outbound calls, because people will pay you when you call them. But I think that sometimes if we put them on inbounds too soon, it's hard for them to see that. They think that only the money comes in the door instead of getting it when you're going out.
We share a true life story with our collectors. There was an article in Collector Magazine in 2005 called Avoid the Trap that you know, chronicle the life of a serial baiter. His name was Ron Swanberg. And so I always share that article and that story with our collectors, and they kind of put it to real life, you know, how somebody could sit out there and do that. And I think they take away good information from that.
Moving on, we've only got, I'm going to try to get through my discussion topics quickly. We've got a bunch of questions that have come in, so I will ask, if you do have a question, now would be a good time to open up your Zoom webinar control panel and start typing it and getting it in as quickly as possible. I'm curious as to whether the type of debt that the collectors will be collecting impacts how a new employee is trained. And Kelly Krueger, maybe you can take that one first.
I mean, there's definitely parts of it that are similar and parts of it that are different. It really all depends on the client specifics and the amount of kind of expectations those clients have. And there's a huge difference between high volume kind of collections and multiple contact kind of collections. So we definitely have two different programs for those two different kinds of collection portfolios, just because in high volume, you don't need to teach them how to skip trace and how to ask really some deep, deep probing questions. And we do sales training for our collectors, and we have two different sales training programs based on the kind of portfolio that they're in. So yes, the length of our training program also changes based on the type of debt that they're collecting on as well.
And I agree with that. And we are primarily student loan higher education, but because of the differing programs in the higher education, we do have different types of training. We start out with the basics and then take them to the excelled levels. But I do, I think there's validity to saying that different debt types require a different type of training, because negotiation, client knowledge, and product knowledge as well could make or break your success. If you don't know the product that you're attempting to sell or collect in this case, then you're going to be less able to do so, unless you have the various training programs that break out the skills that might be necessary to collect that certain debt type.
Okay. I'm going to pause my or my questions for a minute and see if I can't get to some of the questions that have come in from the audience, because, well, in all honesty, they're probably better than some of the questions I have left to ask. So let me start with this one. Are you finding that you have to treat so-called millennials differently than other generations of employees? What works for you? Does anyone want to tackle that one?
I'll try that one.
Oh. I think everybody wants to.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Excellent.
I quit calling them millennials and just say our training is modern learner based. We offer different ways for the employees to learn, you know, self-learning, like one of you had mentioned earlier, you know, you give them tasks and they learn that way, and I think that keeps them occupied. Online learning, tutorials, those types of things help with the modern learner. Because I'm a baby boomer, but I consider myself a modern learner, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's a trend across all generations. Is you know, we forget that the spirit of the sandbox. We all like to learn through fun. That's the best way to learn. Maybe that's not how we were taught to learn as we were growing up, but and the millennials get that because that's how they were brought up, is they get to learn through the spirit of the sandbox. So we're in the same book. We make sure we train everyone the same, but the only difference is computer knowledge. Is sometimes the boomers aren't as savvy on the computer is maybe someone who's fresh out of college. So that's where the only time we ever change our training is in the computer stuff, is where we spend more one-on-one time and we partner up maybe a boomer with a millennial so they can kind of teach each other. So values and then computer skills.
Yeah, and I agree with that, and that a lot of times you determine how they best learn by interacting with them, and sometimes they'll tell you that they're better at hands-on, and then others need someone to show them how to do it. But we have had to adapt our training programs and make some changes, for example, in some PowerPoint presentations, and encourage our trainers to make it fun. It's not just about lecturing. It's about involving them. If the millennial does not want to sit in a classroom and be lectured, they want to be involved, and a lot of times they want to just jump right in and give it a try to see if they can be successful at it. So we found that by doing that and adapting to the individual in the classroom and letting them more or less take the lead, that we've been very successful in that area.
One of the things that we did, just as a side note, is a sit-by bingo game. So it helped the millennials stay active when they are doing side-by-sides with the senior staff. So they have the Y cord hooked in, and they're listening to the call, and they're looking for things like a balance over $300 or an account that ends in 0.01 or things like that. You know, how many times did they take a payment? You know, if they get a payment, and then it's a bingo game that the collector and the new hire gets to win a prize, usually a small gift card. But those types of things really create an environment where that new hire is actively paying attention when they're sitting next to and observing, where they may get bored.
Interesting. Kelly, I wanted to go back to something you said with respect to the difference in maybe computer knowledge. Does that mean that you maybe have different training classes for millennials versus baby boomers, or are they all sort of still mixed into the same training class?
They're still mixed into the same training class, but what we do is we offer computer skills. So if they want to, because, you know, some of the older generations, they don't care about their breaks as much. So we'll say, during your break, if you want, you can stay and we'll teach you some point and click, and we'll teach you about the internet and some more, you know, shortcuts on the computer, and, or we can, you know, eat through, we can eat in the room and work through your lunch, or we're willing to stay after if you'd like to learn some of those skills. And they take us up on it. Most of them take us up on it. So that's how we normally do it.
Interesting. Bob, there's a question here. Would you be willing to share the most frequent call baiting questions that you have on your list?
I'd be glad to. If you want to email me, and I'll get them back to you straight away.
Okay. If you don't have Bob's email address, you can email me. You should have mine as part of your registration for the webinar, and I'll be happy to send that along to Bob. Here's a question going back to the testing. What is the best approach with trainees that don't seem to understand the core training? I'm guessing the option isn't just show them the door.
Not always. I think that, again, you need to determine what is the disconnect, what happened in that learning when you've got a group of individuals and it seems that the majority got it. And you wonder what happened. Sometimes I think sitting down, I had an issue where a young lady could not pass her PCS test. And so determined that she just had test anxiety. So we administered the test orally, and she passed with an excellent score. So I think a lot of times just sitting down and talking to the individual and finding out where the disconnect is.
And I think that goes to Kelly's point. I think she was the one that said it. Is it skill or is it will? And many times, you know, the idea of having a job is great, but actually doing your job is not so great. And I think that that's when you can determine that, you know, if it's a will issue, then, you know, sometimes we do terminate people during the training process because they clearly are not as invested in the company as we want them to be.
So we oftentimes, I think sometimes new hires get so overwhelmed with the amount of information that they need to learn. So sometimes they, let's just say they don't pass the FDCPA test. Well, training doesn't just stop for them. So training continues, and now they're trying to master the FDCPA and learn all the new stuff that they're supposed to learn. And then we're going to do a skills test or a knowledge check on that day. And then, so everything's starting to pile up on them. So what we do with those individuals who get behind in training, and it's a more of a skill thing. They want to do it. They just can't seem to get caught up, and they're overwhelmed. Is we give them a checklist of, okay, so this is what you need to, these are the things you need to be deliverable, that need to be deliverable to us by the end of this day or this week. And these are the tools that you can do that. We'll make sure you don't get you don't get behind, but you also need to take learning into your own hands sometimes. And we can't make you go home and work on this stuff, but if you want to, then here's the tools to do that. So, and again, we put some of that learning into their own hands, and then, but give them deliverables that they have to achieve, like the most important items they need to know.
Another question that came in, what is in your agency training manual and how many pages total is it?
So I've tried several times to reduce it, and I can't. One thing that we've decided to do and worked this last training group was to add sections. So I only give them the section that we're training on, and then the next day I give them the next add. And so what we were finding is that it created them to be more involved in their training manual. So I think my training manual's almost 200 pages, but really they are only using it for the first 8 to 10 days. And then after that, all of the material is on our compliance management system. And then we also created small flipbooks. So I went on Pinterest and found flipbooks that teachers use in their classrooms and redesigned them for collectors. And so we have three of them that they use, kind of unique situations, stalls and objections, and then 8 steps of a collection call. And it creates an environment where they don't really need the binder. The binder really is just used for training, and then they really put it away after that. We may pull it out for different ongoing training, but it's not something that they have on top of their desk that they have to flip through like they used to have to do.
Yeah. And we publish ours on our intro web and have broken it out in sections, as she just said, so that they can come in and then whatever they need some reiteration on, they can go in and click on any given tab that will take them back to a training and even have some real life calls where they can go in and listen to these calls based on certain types of scenarios. But we found that they're more apt to use it. If they put it on their desk, it's going to get buried in paper or put in a drawer. But if they can access it on the intro web, they're more apt to go in and click on the individual tabs just so they can go back and go over areas that they might need some revisiting.
Yeah, we do the same thing. I think we used to print our manuals off, and then through change, you know how the laws kind of change or regulations change, somebody might have an old outdated manual on their desk and they're still referring to the old policies and procedures. And the new hires are now doing it in a different way, so it created inconsistency between the collection floor and the training room. So we are paperless in regards to our training material. Everything is online. It's point and click. If you want to know something about the FDCPA, you click on an FDCPA button. So ours is broken up into call flow, non-typical situations, our system, FDCPA, and state laws. It also has a search function in there. So if you need to know how to deal with, like, let's just say bankruptcy, you can type in bankruptcy and it will bring it up.
Thank you. LaDonna, here's a question asking about the article that you were talking about with regards to the serial plaintiff. If you remembered who, where it was or where it came from or anything like that. Again, could you say that for us again?
Yes. It was Collector Magazine, July of 2005, and you can actually Google the guy. It was Ryan Swanberg, but I have a copy of the article, and if y'all want to email me, or Mike, if you want to distribute it, you know, for how I could send it out.
Sure, that'd be great. So we've just about run out of time, but what I'd like to do is go around the panel and give everybody a chance to share any last words of wisdom with the attendees, if they don't mind. And Kelly Kruger, I'd like to start with you. Kelly, are you there?
The mute button got me.
Oh, sorry.
So I would say my final word of wisdom might be what a hot topic is in our industry right now is, or in our company, is turnover. And the no call, no show in new hire training. So they don't call in and they don't show up. And in our world, that's really where we're focused on creating loyalty in the classroom. So you know, we're teaching them all this really great stuff and how to be a successful collector. But one of the things that we want to first do is teach them how to be a professional employee and understand that this might be a job for you, and you might be here because it's something you're doing in the meantime. But as we all know, because we're in the industry, is this is a career, and a career that can stand the test of time. So how do we create loyalty in our new hire class to help them believe that they can be here for, you know, many, many decades beyond today?
Excellent. Thank you. LaDonna?
Yes, I was just wanted to add that while there is a science to training, it is also a lot of art. And just need to develop a training program that fits your needs, fits the size of your agency and the applicant pool in your area. Just customize it, you know, while hitting all the major things that we need to hit to make our staff successful. But how we do it and what's in our curriculum, you can kind of freestyle a little bit.
Thank you, LaDonna. Bob?
Yeah, a lot of times at ACA fall and spring forums, I've interacted with people who said, we just can't afford to have a trainer and or create a training program. And so we just do it by the seat of our pants. And my response to that is, you can't afford not to dedicate someone to be a full-time trainer, because training is such a necessity, because we know that people learn at different rates. So putting your resources into your training program pay off dividends in the long run by creating more longevity with your employees and limiting your liability.
Great advice. Thanks. And Kelly Parsons O'Brien?
So I think that the other presenters really touched on all the topics. The one thing that I think that we need to look at is kind of ourselves. So whether it's you that does the training or whoever your trainer is have them to really look at, you know, what is their style? You know, are they the problem with the training? And I think that was one thing that was difficult for me when I first took over our training again. And we're so experienced as industry professionals that I think we forget what it feels like to be a beginner. And so that's one thing that I really focused on in my training, is to really look at the material I was covering from a beginner's mind, somebody that doesn't know what a post-data check is, somebody that doesn't understand what third-party disclosure is, all of those things that are just so foreign. I know LaDonna made the comment that we're tapping into a very small pool of applicants, and so the days of getting experienced collectors are few and far between. And so I think that just really looking at your training program from a beginner's mind and not looking at it from somebody that just, you know, that's been doing this for 20 years really helped us change our program and made our new hires much more successful.
Great. Thanks. Before I let everyone go, I wanted to thank LaDonna, Bob, Kelly, and Kelly one more time for their insights and their time today. There was nothing other than their willingness to share that brought them here today, and I really think that they deserve our appreciation for that. So thank you again. Also want to thank Chris Rickman and Peak Revenue Learning for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.peakrevenuelearning.com to learn more about the company, or call 803-521-0030 for more information. Thank you to everybody who signed up and participated today, especially those who asked questions. Stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. A recording of this event will be posted in the next couple of days. Please be sure to enjoy the rest of your day. And to the person who asked for my email address in case anyone needs it, it's mike@canvasbusinessmedia.com. Thanks a lot, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your day. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.